Bibles to the Old Testament book of Isaiah this evening, Isaiah chapter 36. Now, as we come to Isaiah chapter 36, this is the first, as you know, service of 2011. And we're now just past the halfway point in the book of Isaiah. And I'm really looking forward to what the Lord has for us this coming year. I always get excited at the beginning of a new year just to pray about and think about all that God has planned for us in the coming year. And I think that one thing that I've learned in these 29 years of serving the Lord, and we've been in church now for almost, I think, 18 years. Is that what it is? I've lost track. I think almost 18 years. One thing that I've learned is that as long as our outlook is fixed on the Lord, and we keep our eyes on the Lord, then really our outlook is always going to be bright and positive, because we recognize that the Lord is in control of our lives, the Lord is in charge, and also the great news is that our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. And so, even though maybe 2010 had its trials and its difficulties, time is going and marching on, and we're getting closer to meeting Jesus. And so, just as a word of encouragement to you, even if you did have some difficulties in 2010, you probably experienced the grace of God bringing you through that. And so 2011 hopefully will be a good year. And God's grace will see us through 2011 as well. Like Paul put it in Romans chapter 8, he said that I consider that our present sufferings or our trials are not even worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. And so for the believer, as we look forward to this coming year and you know, being in the Word and seeing what God does in our lives and seeing what God does in the ministry through this body of believers, what's exciting for me as a believer is that we have hope as our anchor. And what's ahead for us is glory, a coming glory, a lasting glory, and a never-ending glory in the presence of the Lord. And so we eagerly await, the Bible tells us in Romans chapter 8 as well, we eagerly await our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we are saved, Paul writes. And so the idea of redemption means the ransom in full, or the departure of our bodies. And so, we look forward to what the Lord is going to do, and we wait for it patiently. In the meantime, I would encourage you guys to recognize that God wants to do a work in our lives and through our lives. And while we're here on this earth, we're to put our hand to the plow and labor for the Lord, and our labor for the Lord is not in vain. And so it's exciting just to think about what God is going to do this coming year. And there is that promise that if we don't give up, that we will reap a harvest. And so my encouragement to all of you this coming year is just to continue to stay the course, to fix your gaze, your eyes on Jesus Christ, who is the author and the finisher of our faith, and that as we stay close to Him this coming year, the chief shepherd, that He will lead us and He will guide us in the way that we should go. He will lead us and guide us in righteousness and in the way everlasting. So just a word of encouragement as we get ready to start our new year and this study this evening in Isaiah. So let's go ahead and look at Isaiah chapter 36, the first five verses, and we'll kind of get into what we're going to talk about this evening. Now it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And the king of Assyria sent the Rabshakeh, the great army from Lachish, to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. And he stood by the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. And Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to him. Then Rabshakeh said to them, "Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust? I say you speak of having plans and power for war, but they are mere words. Now in whom do you trust that you rebel against me?" We come tonight to a shift in the book of Isaiah. We have seen that there have been different sections or portions of Isaiah that kind of have different focuses. Tonight, as we come to chapter 36, this portion of the book of Isaiah is the historical section of the book of Isaiah. Isaiah, remember, was a prophet of God, and he lived for between 50 and 60 years. And during that time, he prophesied under the rule of five different kings in the southern kingdom. It reminds me a little bit of Billy Graham. I watched an interview the other night of Billy Graham on Fox, and he's 92 years old now, and they were asking him questions about his life and his ministry. And one of the things that was really amazing is how he had, over all of these years in his ministry, had an influence in almost every one of the president's lives. And that's sort of how Isaiah was. Isaiah was assigned by God to influence his culture and to influence the kings that he served under. Now, as we look at the ministry of Isaiah, we were told in the very beginning of the book of Isaiah that he began his service in the year that King Uzziah died. And then he continued through the reigns of Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah and Josiah. And during the reigns of some of the southern kings of Israel, which, by the way, had a few godly kings. We talked about the northern kingdom of Israel, that there were no godly kings at all. Every single one of the kings in the northern part of Israel was rotten to the core. Every one of them were idolaters. They turned their backs on God. But in the southern kingdom of Judah, there were a few godly, righteous kings. And Hezekiah was one of them. And it was during some of those godly kings that revival would break out in the southern kingdom of Judah. Now, that's why it took longer for God to bring judgment on the southern kingdom, because they were at times spiritually in the right place. Now, not all of the time, but at times. And so Hezekiah was one who was a godly king. He sought to bring about spiritual reformation in the land of Judea. And so he was a godly man. And as we look at his leadership and what he brought about, and we'll look at it here in these next few chapters, it was really a time for the nation of Israel to learn to totally depend on God once again. Now, if our nation, I believe, if our nation is ever going to change, we have to start at the same place that they had to start. We have to turn back to God spiritually. If this nation is going to change, it's not going to happen, I don't believe, politically, it's going to happen spiritually, because only God can do a work in the hearts of people. And as hearts changed, and people will then change, and then the nation will change. Because as our hearts change, our passions change, our desires change, our directions change, everything changes when our hearts get right with God. I was watching also another program the other night on television, and they were interviewing several different people about what they thought about our nation. And, you know, they were all talking about what they thought that was going to fix the nation and the problems that we're having in our country. And there was one lady, a black lady, that was on there, and it was really neat what she had to say, because she said something that kind of stumped all of them. They were all talking about political changes, and they were all talking about the finances and the stock market and all of these different things. And all of a sudden, she just comes out and she says, you know, that all of the problems in our nation, she said, are tied to one problem, and that is the problem that we are having spiritually. And she said, that's the first thing that we need to fix, is we need to, as a nation, turn back to God. Well, this is what Hezekiah was all about. He was calling the nation back to God. Now, we're told about him that he was a very great king. In 2 Chronicles chapter 29, it says this: Hezekiah began his reign when he was 25 years old, and he reigned for 29 years in Jerusalem. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father David had done. That wasn't his father, but David, of course, was the standard of righteousness for kings. Now, when you think about Hezekiah and the testimony that God gives there in 2 Chronicles chapter 29, I was thinking to myself, what a great testimony to have. What a legacy for a man, a human being, to leave behind, that you would live your life in such a way that the Holy Spirit would pen about you that you did what was right in the sight of the Lord. What a great testimony, what a great legacy. That was King Hezekiah. Now, I don't know how it is for you, but, you know, one of the things that I want to try to accomplish in life, you know, a lot of people have goals in life. They want to become a millionaire, they want to be famous, whatever. I just want to be faithful. I want to be faithful to the end, and I want to answer that phone call. No, I want to be faithful to the end, and I want to finish well. But I realize that as a Christian, that the devil is always trying to shipwreck our faith. He's always trying to derail us. And so for me, my goal as a believer is perseverance and endurance, to continue to live my life for the Lord. And what a blessing like Hezekiah, that at the end, after it was all said and done, that's what it was said about him, that he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. Now, a special note that I want to kind of point out here. Even though Hezekiah was a reformer, and even though Hezekiah was godly, it didn't keep him from trouble or distress. And we're going to see that tonight, that trouble and distress happened in his life. It happened in his reign. Even though he was trying to do the right thing, even though he was trying to serve God, he still had times of difficulty. He still had trials. Now, sometimes people think, well, if I serve God and I'm living for the Lord and I'm trying to be faithful, that everything's always going to be perfect. And I don't believe that that's true. And so here was a man who was trying to serve God. Now, it didn't mean he was perfect. Even though he was a godly king, he wasn't without his faults, and neither are we today. And that's another encouragement, that we can be godly, but we're not faultless and we're not sinless. Now, one of the things we'll see that he made a mistake of doing, and one of the mistakes that he made is he tried to appease, or he tried to deal with, or buy, or bribe his way out of being invaded by Sennacherib, or Cherub, however you want to say it, the king of Assyria. And so one of the things that he did, I think that he kind of blew it in, even though the Lord said he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. Like I said, he wasn't perfect. What he did is he went into the temple and he stripped the gold and the silver from God's temple to pay the king off, to try to say, okay, look, if we pay you, don't attack us. But he paid him off, and you can read about that in 2 Kings chapter 18 on your own. But you know what? It didn't work, because he still came against them anyways. And so a lesson that we can learn is that, you know, if you kind of look at Sennacherib as a type or a picture of the devil, you know, you can't appease the devil, because it never works, because he always wants more. So instead of trusting in God and looking to the Lord, he tried to trust in the wisdom of man. He tried to trust in the flesh, tried to pay off the king, the other king. And it turned out to be a very costly mistake. So when you look at him and his life and how he did things, you know, he wasn't perfect. And you look at our nation, and I think about how our nation often does the same kinds of things, trying to use money to buy friends, or our policies, you know, are not much different maybe than Hezekiah's was at that point, thinking that, you know, if we just you know, give people weapons, or we give people money, that they're going to be our friends. And what we find out is that usually doesn't work. You know, many of our once friends in this nation that we've given millions and millions of dollars to and weapons to are now our enemies. And so, you know, flesh gives birth to flesh pretty much. If you do things in the flesh, that's usually what ends up happening. It turns out to be the flesh, and the flesh is never good. I like how J. Vernon McGee puts it. He said, we need to learn, like Israel had to learn, who our real friend is. And we need to turn to the Lord our God. He is our help in time of trouble. And that's what Hezekiah ended up learning, the great lesson he ended up learning. And we won't get into it till next week in chapter 37. But he learned that it was God indeed that was the only one that was going to be able to deliver him in their time of trouble. So God is a friend that has promised never to leave us or never to forsake us. Now let's go ahead and take a look at some of these verses. Look at verse 1. It says, now it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. Now I like those words. And it came to pass. Good words. Good words. You find those words quite often in Scripture. And it came to pass. A good thing to remember in life is that things will come to pass. Things do pass. The longer I live, the more I realize how quickly time goes by. And those words are important. And it came to pass. It seems like just the other day, well, I was sharing on Sunday that was the year 2000. Now it's 2011. I was listening to our radio station the other day, and and I was going somewhere, and I flipped it on during the time I was on. And it was interesting because we have the Gospel of Matthew on the radio now. And as I was listening to it, I was just kind of taken back because as I was sharing on the radio, I talked about my son Jared. And when I was talking about him, he had just turned 14. Now he's 26. And I'm like, wow, that's an old teaching. And I'm like, wow, I'm old, you know. And it's just like so crazy how time goes by so fast. When we moved here, we had no daughters. And now we have a 15-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old daughter. And my 15-year-old daughter is driving. And it's like, it's really increased my prayer life. It's really like amazing. So don't tell her I said that. I know one of you is going to tell her, and she's going to be mad at me later. Dad, you know. But, you know, time, as it comes to pass, time passes. And as King Hezekiah is in his 14th year in his reign, a trial hits. And the kingdom, the southern kingdom, is in the pickle now. And Sennacherib is this very powerful king, the king of Assyria. He's bearing down now on Jerusalem. He had already taken the northern kingdom 15 years prior. He had taken the capital, Samaria, captive. He had taken the people into captivity. And now he's coming against the southern kingdom of Judah. And Sennacherib, he boasted, you know, already at this point, he boasted that he had already taken 46 walled cities of Judah. So he seemed unstoppable. And, you know, when you look at him and his army and all of that, this guy was now the big dog on the block. It seems like there's always a nation or a couple of nations that are the powerful nations in the world throughout history. Well, this was a period of time when this nation was the big dog on the block. And they came against a little tiny, the southern kingdom of Judah, little tiny place, little city, Jerusalem. Well, it wasn't a big city back then. But the thing that they were doing is they were coming in the strength of men. What they didn't factor in is that they were coming against the nation of Israel, whose God was the God of gods. And they didn't take that into the equation. In fact, we'll see that they mocked the God of Israel. And it ended up costing them big time. We'll see that in chapter 37. You know, when you look at this whole story, one of the kind of the overriding lessons of this story is, you know, beware of mocking God, because it'll always backfire on you. You know, you can safely say that if you mock God, it's going to backfire on you. And so the Assyrians' pride, they made them, it made them believe that they were invincible. It made them believe a lie that the God of Israel was no different than the other gods that they had overcome and the other nations they had defeated. And they were about to have a rude awakening. And the Bible always tells us over and over that God opposes the proud. And so these were very prideful people. And whenever a man or a nation is proud and they think they don't need God, you know, they better watch out. Or they come against the Lord, they better watch out. And that's one of the overriding lessons of this story. And so we see here where they came from. It says that the king of Assyria came up against all the fortified cities of Judah. And then in verse 2 it says, then the king of Assyria sent the Rabshakeh with the great army from Lachish. That was one of the cities, the walled cities in the southern kingdom of Judah that they had already taken captive. And they had sort of made that their base of operations. And so they came with a great army from there to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. And he stood at the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. Now, Rabshakeh is a title, but it's kind of he's kind of spoken here like if it's a name. But he was the highest in rank to the king. It's sort of a five-star general, if you will. And he comes to Jerusalem, and he comes with a message from the king. And it's really a doomsday message for Hezekiah, he comes with his great army to back him up. And now they're at the aqueduct there, just outside the city walls. Now, at this point, when they arrive, Hezekiah sends out some representatives to negotiate with him. And we'll see that these guys, these three guys that come out, are three trusted, loyal men in his leadership. And you think about Hezekiah, and you think about, I think about this from my perspective as a pastor, and, you know, just reading books on leadership and all. And what you find is that you look at leaders, and you look at Hezekiah, and he had men that he felt were loyal and who could be trusted and who would stand by him when the times got tough. And, you know, those are hard to find, I think, you know, people that you can trust that will stand by you through thick and thin. And I have found over the years what a blessing to have people like that, that you can trust. And then I've also recognized on a few occasions where I thought I could trust someone or someone was loyal and I was proven wrong. And so, you know, you look at these guys that come out and they represent the king. And I'm sure that he had placed a lot of trust in these guys. And so look at verse 3. It says, "And Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to him." And so these are the guys that come out. Look at verse 4. "Then Rabshakeh said to them, 'Say now to King Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust?'" Now, as this conversation progresses, I want you guys to notice something. It sort of parallels how the devil tries to question, or how he tries to plant doubt and fears in our lives and make us believe that it's futile, that it is foolish to trust God, that it's foolish to serve God. And so just like in the first book in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, when the devil came and tempted Adam and Eve, and remember how the devil worded what he worded? He said, "Did God really say?" Trying to plant those doubts. He still does the same thing. And that's kind of what he's doing here through Rabshakeh. He comes and he begins to plant all of these doubts in their minds. And he starts out by kind of, you know, chopping away at the things that they had put their confidence in. He says, "And what confidence is this in which you trust?" And he starts to attack and to tear down any defenses that they may have erected for themselves. And he says, I come from the great king, you know, as opposed to the ones that they were trusting in. They were trusting in Egypt. And so the nation of Israel had, or the Judah, southern kingdom of Judah, had turned to Egypt. And that was one of the problems. We've seen this already in the book of Isaiah. They turned to Egypt for help. They had gone to the pharaohs and they were trusting in the arm of the flesh instead of God. And the Lord had rebuked them for that already. And so the king, this King Assyria, comes now and he says, "You know, what are you guys doing? What are you trusting in? Where's your confidence?" In other words, he was almost mockingly saying, "You guys think that Egypt's going to be able to deliver you?" Now look at verse 5. It says, I say you speak of having plans and power for war, but they are mere words. Now in whom do you trust that you rebel against me?" Now he's bringing this message from the king, right? And so he's delivering this message. And as they're hearing these words come with a lot of sarcasm, a lot of mockery. And so Rabshakeh says, "You know, you guys talk a big talk. You say that you have a plan and you say that you have power." But he says, "Those are just words. Talk is cheap." He says, "You can't back up your big talk with anything. So who are you trusting in that you would rebel against me?" Verse 6. And so he says, "Look, you are trusting in the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him." So he says to him, "Hey, guys, don't think that you can lean on Egypt. Don't think that Egypt is and the Pharaoh is going to be able to deliver you, because all he is an old, weak, ready to shatter, broken reed. He can't support you. You'll end up wounded by the staff itself." He says, "So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him." So Rabshakeh is doing what, you know, I guess I grew up watching boxing, and I remember Muhammad Ali. Remember Muhammad Ali? How many of you guys remember him? Remember whenever he would go to get before the fight, he would always talk a big old talk. He would always brag. He would always boast. He would always, you know, come up with these crazy sayings. "Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee," and all this crazy stuff. You know, and he was always telling the other guy, his opponent, what he was going to do to him. And that's called posturing. And that's what this guy is doing, Rabshakeh is doing. He's chopping and chopping and chopping away at the things that they were trusting in so that they would, you know, surrender. Now, one thing that I will say here is, and when he says, you guys, what are you doing trusting in Egypt? One thing I will say here is that what he says is true. They shouldn't have been trusting in the arm or the strength of man. They should have been trusting in the Lord. So sometimes I can just say this, not everything that the devil says is an out and out lie, because sometimes he mixes truth with his lies. Now, in this case, as he mocks Egypt, he's saying, you guys are trusting in a false hope. Now look at verse 7. But if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar here in Jerusalem? So what is he doing now? He's down below. Picture this. He's down below the wall. They're up on the wall and he's yelling at them and he's telling them, he says, look, you guys are saying you're trusting in God, but isn't it Hezekiah who tore down the altars of God? And, you know, he's mocking now their trust in God. He's saying, how's God going to deliver you? You tore down all of his altars. But what he's doing here is he's speaking in ignorance like so many people do when it comes to God. People say stuff like, you know, like this all the time. And they say stuff like this because they're ignorant of God, or they're misinformed about God, or they're out and out in lies about God. See, he knew some facts, but he didn't know all of the facts. He knew that Hezekiah had destroyed some of the high places. Remember when I said that Hezekiah brought reforms? He went in and he looked at what was going on in the nation when he became the king. And he said, you know what? We need to turn back to God. We need to go in all of these idolatrous high places that are throughout the land, where people are worshiping these false gods and sacrificing on the high places to these idols. He went in and he tore all of them down. And so this Rabshakeh guy, he thinks that these high places are directly related to God. But they were places of idolatry. And so Hezekiah had brought reforms, but Rabshakeh was ignorant of the one true God, and he thought all of the gods were the same, or that all of the altars were the same, when there are many altars that are false altars, and there's only one true God, and not every road leads to God. And so he sort of had that mindset. And so the problem in the nation of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah was their idolatry. And Hezekiah had brought at least a portion or a partial solution to the nation's problems in getting them to turn back to God and then going back to worshiping God in the temple in Jerusalem. And so he brought reforms. And you know how we need that in this country. We need to turn back to God. You know, I think about this. We have our high places. We have our false idols and our altars. We just don't call them the same things that they did, maybe. But we have our gods: mammon, money, Bacchus, alcohol, hedonism, pleasure, you know, pornography and sex. And they had all their sex gods and goddesses that they worshipped as well. And so, you know, Hezekiah tore those altars down and they turned back to the one true God. And, you know, think about America. Boy, don't we need to do the same thing. So Rabshakeh says, how is God going to help you if you tore down his altars? And so he's mocking, he's slandering. One of the nicknames of Satan is, or one of the names of Satan is that he's a slanderer. That's what he does. He's the accuser. And so he's attacking. And this is what he's doing. He's attacking their faith. Look at verse 8 and verse 9. Now, therefore, I urge you, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria. Now, they had already given money to him. Now he's wanting more. That's how the devil is. He says, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to put riders on them. How then will you repel one captain of the least of my master's servants and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? He mocks some more here. He says, hey, you guys are so few and you're so weak. Even if I gave you 2,000 horses and you used them for battle, you couldn't even put men on them. That's how weak and how, you know, lame you guys are. And so he's chopping and chopping and chopping at their confidence. And he's using here psychological warfare against them. And that's often how the devil will do it. He'll try to tell us stuff, and he'll tell us all of these things, trying to sow fear, trying to tell us to give up, trying to sow doubt. And so this is what this guy's doing. You know, it's posturing. He's posturing, and he's using all these threats and these things, you know, and it's just a common thing. And so Rabshakeh is using fear and mockery and all of these things. Now, it really gets deep in what he says next. Look at verse 10. He says, "Have I now come up without the Lord against this land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, 'Go up against this land and destroy it.'" He says here, "Hey, guys, you think God's going to protect you? God told me to come here and to wipe you out. God's on our side. You think you can stand against Assyria with God on our side?" That's what he's telling them. You know, you ever heard these nutcases that say, you know, "God told me to do this" or whatever? That's sort of what he's doing here. He's just saying crazy stuff. And this is Rabshakeh. He doesn't even know God. He doesn't even know who he is. He thinks he's worshipped in the high places like they did with the idols. And yet here he is, you know, making all of these crazy, you know, proclamations. And so far he said, the Egyptians won't help you. He said, the Lord won't help you. You can't even ride horses. And besides all that, he sent us to destroy you. And so he's chopping and chopping and chopping away. And, you know, the danger is this, is when we listen to a lie long enough, you have a chance to start believing that lie. And I think that's why it's really, we all need to be very careful about listening to the lies of the enemy or who we listen to and where you get your information from. Because if you get fed the wrong information, you can start to believe that. And so he's getting them to try to doubt God in all of this. So look at verse 11. "Then Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah said to Rabshakeh, 'Please speak to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. And do not speak to us in Hebrew, in the hearing of the people who are on the wall.'" You hear what they're saying here? He's getting to them. Rabshakeh's getting to them because he's saying all of these things. And finally they speak up and they say, "Hey, listen, could you please speak to us in Aramaic?" Aramaic was a language of the Assyrians. Hebrew was the language of the Israelites at this time. And so he says, "Look, don't speak to us in Hebrew. Speak to us in Aramaic. We understand what you're saying. So talk to us like that, because we don't want all the people to hear what you're saying." And then, you know, they start to doubt. And you know, it's a big mistake that they say this to him, because what's the first thing that he does? The very thing that they ask him not to do is the very thing that he does. Verse 12, "But the Rabshakeh said, 'Has my master sent me to your master and to you to speak these words, and not to the men who sit in the wall, who will eat and drink their own waste with you?'" So, verse 13, "Then the Rabshakeh stood and he called out with a loud voice," notice, "in Hebrew, and said, 'Hear are the words of the great king, the king of Assyria.'" Now he has the people's ear. First he was just talking to talking to the leaders or the representatives of King Hezekiah. But now he's talking to all of the people in the language that they understand. And so, you know, he says, please don't speak to us in Hebrew, speak in Aramaic. But what does he do? He speaks to him in Hebrew. Remember when I was in sixth grade. And in fourth grade, I'd hit my eye and damaged my eye major. And ended up in the hospital for an entire week, and I almost lost my eye. And anyways, when I got to like sixth or seventh grade or somewhere in there, I went to a summer camp. And when we were at the summer camp that summer, you had different activities that you could do during the camp. And it was like a sports summer camp. And I used to love to box. And so I had an opportunity during the summer camp to sign up for the boxing. Well, when I got there, I thought, wait a minute, my eyes, you know, has been hurt really bad, and so maybe I shouldn't box. And so the big mistake I made is that I decided to box, but I told the guy that I was going to box against, "Whatever you do, don't hit me in the left eye." Guess exactly where he aimed the whole time, you know. That's what this guy does. "Don't talk to us in Hebrew." He talks to him in Hebrew. And then he tells him something totally, I mean, basically, he says, look, he says, you guys are going to eat and drink your own waste. He says, he says, you guys don't, you know, think that God's going to deliver you guys. Don't think that Hezekiah is going to deliver you. And so he starts to plant the doubt now in the people. Look at verse 13. Then Rabshakeh stood, we just read that. He called out in Hebrew and he says, hear the words of the great king. Verse 14. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you. So now he tries to turn the people against the king. And so listen what happens next. Verse 15. Nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord. Hezekiah was a godly man. He was a godly king. He had brought reformation to the nation. He had taught the people to turn back to God, to trust in God. And so now what does he say? Just like the devil comes and says all the time, don't trust in the Lord. Don't think that the Lord's going to be able to help you. So that's what he says. No, let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city will not be given into your hand of Assyria. He says, don't believe that. Don't believe what Hezekiah tells you that. Verse 16, do not listen to Hezekiah. For thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a present and come out to me. And every one of you will eat from his own vine and every one from his own fig tree. And every one of you will drink the waters of his own cistern. What is he doing here? He's saying, don't trust in the Lord. Don't listen to your king. Just turn against him. Surrender. Bring out a gift. Bring out a present. Surrender to us. And if you surrender to us, he says, everything's going to be just great. Every one of you is going to eat from his own vine and everyone's going to eat from his own fig tree. In other words, he's promising him all of these benefits. And isn't that how the devil tempts us? If you serve me, don't serve God. Don't listen to those guys. Listen to me. And if you'll serve me and you'll surrender, you'll be blessed. You'll have all this stuff. But it's a lie. I like what Matthew Henry says. He says, the devil will deceive by promising liberty when in fact his plan is to lead us into the basest captivity and slavery. That's how he works. He's a liar and the father of lies. So he promises them all of these benefits. And then listen to what he says in verse 17. Until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards. He's basically saying, you don't need this inheritance God gave to you. We got it better. This is where I'm going to take you. You're going to have all of this stuff. You're going to have a land that's full of grain. It's full of new wine, full of vineyards and bread. So he's putting that doubt in the people now so that the people will not trust God and will not listen to Hezekiah and will surrender to him. Verse 18, beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Has any of the gods of the nations delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Wow. He says, look, none of the gods of these other nations have been able to deliver them. What makes you think that the Lord's going to deliver you guys? See, he doesn't understand who God is. He doesn't understand that God is not an idol, a worthless idol like the nations around the nation of Israel were worshiping. So now he's trying to get them to turn against God, against the king, against everything that they had trusted in. He's trying to tear it away from them. And verse 19, where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of that really hard word, Sepharvaim? Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand? And so, you know, these are the gods that the Samaritan, the northern kingdom had turned to idolatry. You know, they had turned away from God. And the reason that God didn't deliver the northern kingdom was because of their idolatry. And so, you know, he's just, again, attacking and attacking and attacking. Verse 20, who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their countries from my hand that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? Basically, what is he saying? We're stronger than any God. There's no God that can stand up against us. Can you see the pride and the arrogance? But I love verse 21. But they held their peace and answered him not a word. You know, sometimes that's the best thing to do. It's hold your peace and answer not a word. It tells us in the book of Proverbs, never answer a fool according to their folly. And so they didn't answer. They held their peace. For the king's commandment was, notice, do not answer him. A lot of wisdom there. You know, they didn't argue with him. They didn't, you know, never get in an argument with the devil. You know, so often, you know, people do that. You know, wisdom is just don't squabble with the devil. Let the Lord take care of it. Let the Lord fight your fight. You don't have to try to fight your fight. I remember Mr. C told me one time a saying that I'll never forget. Never get in a spraying match with a skunk, you know. And so that's sort of what this guy was. He was a skunk. And so they don't answer a word. Verse 22, then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph, the recorder, came to Hezekiah. Notice the guys, these guys, they had a passion for God and a love for God. What had they just heard? They had heard this guy, Rabshakeh, mocking the God of Israel. They had heard them, this guy, dishonor and slander the king and his faith. And so they came with their clothes torn. And the reason that they did that back in those days, whenever they tore their clothes, it was a sign of grief. It was a sign of sorrow, of repentance, you know. And so they come with their clothes torn in the presence of the king, and they told him all of the words of Rabshakeh. Now, I wish we had time, but you can read ahead on your own to look at chapter 37, because it's a beautiful story of what King Hezekiah does at that point. It's a great lesson for all of us, that when the enemy comes against us, when he's mocking, when he's scoffing, when he's trying to attack us and destroy our faith, what does Hezekiah do? We'll learn about that next time. But it's a great lesson. Read ahead on your own, and let's see how the Lord speaks to you tonight. Maybe when you get home, read it. We'll look at it next week. But at this point, we're going to stop here in chapter 36, and we can see the dilemma that they are in. What's cool about this, though, is that there's never any problem that we face in life that God can't handle. And that's the great part of this story. When they turn to the Lord intervenes. And that's what we need to do as well. Why don't you guys come up, the worship team? And we're going to sing a couple of songs before we partake of communion.